Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Welcome to The Conversation's Politics Podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Sam Dastyari is a former State Secretary of the New South Wales ALP, and now he's a Labor Senator from that state. At 31, he's currently the youngest member in the Labor caucus, but he's rapidly built a profile, especially through his work on Senate committees. Currently, he's chairing the Senate inquiry into corporate tax avoidance. And he's been ruffling feathers in the business community by saying that the tax office should be naming and shaming companies that engage in tax minimisation. He spoke to us more about this idea and the taxation issue in general. We also talked about the coming ALP National Conference, and he reaffirmed his commitment to gay marriage, but said that he didn't support a binding vote for all Labor members, which will be one of the issues that will be controversial at that conference in July. Sam Dastyari, how big is this problem of corporate tax avoidance in Australia?
Huge. I mean, we just heard today, as part of our inquiry, we heard from the representatives from Treasury, and their point they made is they can't put a figure on this. They can't even calculate how big this is and what an issue is for Australia. But here are some figures that we do know. We know that The Economist magazine says this is a $20 trillion a problem a year across the world. And we know the tax office says more than $60 billion is being moved in questionable transfers between Australia and bank accounts in tax havens, the 23 already identified tax havens, $60 billion a year. So we know of $60 billion that's in question. We know it's a $20 trillion worldwide problem. But the fact is, we can't actually get a proper handle numerically on how big an issue this is for Australia.
So what are you looking to achieve in this Senate inquiry? Are you trying to find out what you can of the practices of these companies? Are you trying to put pressure on the government?
Look, a couple of things. I think firstly, there is a role in shining a spotlight on some of these practices and what's been going on. The truth is, a lot of this has been going on for a long time. And the issue of multinational tax avoidance, which was perhaps a peripheral issue a couple of years ago, has really come into the limelight, and I think that's a good thing. So firstly, yes, there is the objective of just trying to shine some light and some public awareness. You know, as part of this inquiry, we had the CEOs of the three big tech companies, Google, Apple, and Microsoft, come. The information they presented, while it wasn't necessarily revolutionary or new, I mean, some of that is information that if you sat down on the internet searched and researched, you would find that information. But there is a value in simply having that in the public space. That's the first point. Second thing is, you have to address this fundamental issue that's facing the country, and that is the best way forward to go through a multilateral approach, rather,
like the
G20 OECD, or in the meantime, should we be taking action ourselves unilaterally? That is the really big question and the policy question. And I have to say, Michelle, the evidence we're getting is that there's actually there's a view that we have to be very careful how we trade unilaterally, but that it can be done. And finally, I think there has to be, as part of the debate, and something I'm quite strong about, in terms of public disclosure of some of not just what the company is prepared to reveal, but how the tax office has operated in this area.
Now, you have argued that the tax office or the government should name and shame some of these companies. What would that achieve?
Okay, I think it achieves two things. Firstly, I think if you're a company who is engaging in tax minimization behavior, and you know, at that level, when you're setting up global or international structures to minimize your tax, I'm not saying they should name everybody, but they in themselves have a report, which they've given to us redacted, of who the worst offenders are in their opinion. And because there is a gray line between what is illegal and what is immoral, let's be clear, Tax avoidance is immoral but legal. Tax evasion is illegal. The reality is the line between tax avoidance and tax evasion can sometimes be open to interpretation. It's a grey line. This isn't a black and white kind of situation. A lot of it is about interpretation, about intent, and about structure. So, I believe that naming some of these worst offenders, firstly, will give some power to the Australian consumers and to actually be able to have that debate. Now, we know about Googles of the world and the tech companies and the Apples. We know largely because of international information that's been leaked, nothing because of anything coming out of Australia. I think Australian consumers having that information is a good thing and allows them to make their decisions. Secondly, there's a big question about how big a problem this is and how wide it is. And what I mean is, we know that it's a problem in the tech industry. There's been a lot of media reports that it's also a problem in the mining industry, and the mining CEOs are coming as part of this inquiry this week, and obviously we'll be putting some of the questions to them. But the question is this an issue that you have to address as a sectoral problem, or is it an economy-wide national problem across all industries? Now, hard to answer that question if you don't have the information on who are the companies. And what worries me here isn't just that they're not giving it to us. I mean, the ATO hasn't given it to the government either.
Is it legal for the ATO to make that sort of disclosure, though?
Under parliamentary privilege, yes. Yes. I mean, look, the commissioner said, and the tax commissioner has been very clear, the tax commissioner says that he has a right not to give the information under public interest immunity, effectively arguing that it is not in the public interest for this information to be revealed. He has a right to make that determination. I respect the right that he has to make that determination. I believe it's the wrong determination to make. I believe it is not in the public interest to withhold this information. And that being said, the tax commissioner himself concedes that if he were to hand it over, it would not be breaching privacy provisions because of parliamentary privilege, but nonetheless, he has chosen not to.
So what's the argument against handing it over?
The argument against is that it damages the relationship with, I mean, I'm not here to make their argument for them, but the argument is that it damages the relationship with their taxpayers and businesses, and that the trust relationship would be damaged, and that it is unprecedented. Now, my counter to that would be, firstly, I think it would be naive to think that companies are handing over their tax information to the tax office for any reason other than they need to do it at a statutory level. I mean, we talk about this friendly relationship and sharing of information. Let's not kid ourselves. If companies weren't legally obliged to hand over information to the tax office, they wouldn't. This wouldn't change that. And secondly, on the issue of precedent, and look at the legitimate concern, but my point is this. This has been a problem for 25 years now, 30 years, perhaps longer. If we keep doing what we've always done in the past, we'd be naive to think we're going to get some different outcomes. Yes, this would be something new and it would be different, but I also think it put a lot of companies on notice, and I don't think that's a bad outcome.
This movement of profits to other countries to avoid tax is often used as an argument for Australian company tax rates to be dropped dramatically. Do you think that that is a legitimate argument, or are we really dealing with something quite other here? Could we never match the rate in Singapore or wherever?
We're never going to match the rate. I mean, so the corporate tax rate in this country is 30%. This is before, you know, you get deductions for R&D and a few other things, 30%. Singapore is 17. Hong Kong, 16.5%. Ireland's 12.5%, and places like Luxembourg and that, you can do sweetheart deals, and in Bermuda, it's zero. You know, the idea that we're going to be competing for some kind of economic race to the bottom, I think is a very, very dangerous step. But I just want to take a quick step back and kind of perhaps explain for our listeners, you know, what is actually going on here? Because what are we actually talking about? Because the structures are really complicated, but the principles are incredibly simple. The principle that these companies engage in is, how do I artificially make my company as unprofitable as possible in Australia and as profitable as possible in a tax haven? So how do I artificially make it less profitable here, more profitable elsewhere for tax purposes? Now, there's really two ways you do that. Either you move around your profit or you move around your debt. And what you're finding here is a lot of what we heard yesterday from the tech companies, the allegation is they're moving around their profits. And at the same time, the allegation against the mining companies in that is they're loading up their Australian companies with debt. The question is, and when you're looking at a policy approach, you have to look at those two. How do you tackle those two challenges?
There were some sharp exchanges for the committee this week with some of the senators, obviously quite frustrated that they couldn't get information or that the executives were dancing around the questions. What was your impression from the evidence of these big players? Do you think those executives were there to sort of say up you to the committee?
Oh, look, I've got to say the chutzpah and the level of pride they took in some of what they were saying, I think was a bit disconcerting. Also, I mean, look, it is very hard to believe that the CEO of Google Australia had never heard of this, a double Irish Dutch sandwich.
Could you explain a double Irish Dutch sandwich?
Yeah, very simple. I mean, look, what effectively means is you create a company in Ireland, a company in the Netherlands, a company back in Ireland, and the three of them transact with one another to minimise your tax. Now, again, how all this happens is actually quite complex. Is looking at transfer pricing and a lot of kind of internal structures get put in place. But in a nutshell, you're moving the money in, out, and you're effectively loading your... The way you structure your three companies is you load your profit into the top company and everything else in the third. And it gets fairly technical, but you know, you've got that. You can use the other famous ones, the Singapore sling, which is where you sling your money through Singapore, which is what the allegation is that
Google
does.
Sounds like a cocktail.
Yeah, well, you can do what Microsoft do, which is the Bermuda black hole.
Before we go down these holes too far,
we're going to have to get a drink. But no, so look, there is, so you had the CEO of Apple say that I'd never heard of this term before. Now, if you spend 5 minutes doing research on the tax affairs of Apple, every article, every story, I mean, it's been the front page of international papers, newspapers. The idea, it makes you question either they were not being quite forthcoming with the truth, or they have no idea how their own business is run. And I suspect it's the former, not the latter.
Now, I wonder if we can just turn from this tax inquiry to what's happening in Labor. The ALP National Conference is fast approaching. It's in July, and there are going to be some difficult issues being faced there. Now, you're a mover and shaker in the New South Wales, right?
Once
a mover and shaker, always a mover and shaker, I think. There's a lot of agitation before the conference for it to call for the formal recognition of Palestine, and this would be a major step beyond the present policy, which is for a two-state policy. Do you think there will be any change in the party's stand on Palestine?
Well, look, I can tell you my personal position. I don't want to kind of preempt what the conference will or won't do. I'm not sure about that. The motion at the New South Wales ALP conference, which from recollection I certainly supported, I think I even seconded, I think I seconded, which was a Bob Carr-led motion, was that, kind of it talked about the legal nature of certain settlements, talked about the plight of the Palestinian people, and then concluded with that if steps aren't being taken to address these issues, Labor should explore recognition of Palestine in our next government. Now, I understand the Queensland branch and the South Australian branch of the party, I could be wrong on the two branches, moved motions that went slightly further than that motion and went so far as to directly call for the recognition of Palestine. I could be slightly wrong about it being, may have been Tasmania, not Queensland, but Queensland and South Australia. Look, my personal views on this have been well known, I've been quite open about it. I think the Labor Party motion from New South Wales was a good middle of the road solution. I think that's something that I've obviously supported at a New South Wales level, and I'm not a hypocrite. I'm not going to support something at a New South Wales level and not support it at a federal level. That being said, I think the history of the last Labor government in this space needs to be recognised, and that
which was awkward.
Well, the history, well, the position we took in.
There were divisions.
Oh, yeah, there were huge divisions. No. Let's be clear. You're completely right. This is a huge live debate within the centre-left of politics, as it has been for 65 years, as it is everywhere in the world. I mean, this isn't an easy issue anywhere in the world, let alone in Australia.
But particularly difficult for Bill Shorten, though, because the Victorian right in the ALP has been much more pro-Israel and much more suspicious of going down this track.
One slight bit of the premise that I would reject, but it may be cemented, is that I don't see this in a debate about being pro or anti-Israel. I think you can be very pro the right of Israel and also be supportive of the Palestinian people. But that's not really the point you're making. I think the point you're making is that, or if the point is you're making is that, is this and has this been a contentious issue in the Labor Party? Definitely. Will it continue to be so? Definitely. But it has been for 65 years.
Another contentious issue, perhaps not quite so contentious, is gay marriage. Now, the party supports the move to gay marriage, a move to gay marriage, but the division is over whether ALP MPs like yourself should be bound or given a conscience vote.
Yeah, look, I mean, and there's going to be...
At the moment, there's a conscience vote.
And there's going to be huge pressure that it become a binding vote, or there's been talk of that. Firstly, I'll tell you my position. I support marriage equality. I think it's timely. I think to an extent, and not exclusively, it is a generational issue. And you find that in all the polling you find everywhere. I'm the youngest member of the Labor Party. I am the youngest member of the Labor Party caucus. And the younger members of the caucus tend to be more supportive as a rule, which is a reflection on the community as well. So yes, I'm a big supporter of marriage equality. I will vote for marriage equality if a bill came before the parliament. The issue is whether or not it should be a binding vote. And I don't support it being a binding vote. And I don't support it being a binding vote for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I think you have to respect the fact that there are a lot of different views on this issue, and they're deeply held views and they're genuine views. And the fact that 15 years ago, the idea of marriage equality, this was not a consensus position 15 years ago. And I think it's unfair to turn around and say, oh, well, people who have consistently held a position within our party over a period of time, 10, 15 years ago, that was, you know, a very well-held majority position, who are now in the minority, are unable to continue to exercise that view. I think that is a mistake, firstly. Secondly, for those of us who support marriage equality, there's a tactical reason why we shouldn't support a binding vote, and that is the Conservatives have a binding vote opposing it. A huge part of our argument is that we're calling on them to also have a conscience vote. And those who support marriage equality and, you know, have a look at the tactics, tactically, it is more in the interest of the advocates of marriage equality to have a progressive have a non-binding vote across both parties. There is a path to that becoming a majority position, but Labor being bound on it, with the possibility of some people walking away, and the Libs being bound on it and not supporting, is not the outcome I think anyone wants. So I think there is a conscience vote's the right thing to do, but I also think for those of us who support marriage equality, it's tactically smart.
Now, a third very potent issue is asylum seeker policy for the conference. Should the ALP change its present stance of opposing turnbacks?
Not yet, not at this stage, but I think what we have to do, and we're going to have to do, is have the discussion about how, is there a way? Before you get to the specific of that, just one quick step away from the broad principle. Is there a way you can have a safe, fair, ethical, moral offshore processing system that gives people rights, particularly legal rights, they currently, I think, is a real concern that they're lacking, and at the same time doesn't create encouragement for people to do dangerous things like get on boats, which nobody wants. I think that's unsafe for them. It's not in the national interest either. It's bad for everybody. Is there a path to do that? Yes. Does that mean you need to have a better regional solution? Definitely. As part of that, if you're going down that path, should turnbacks be addressed? I believe it will need to be addressed if and only if the framework is right. Frankly, we should not be revisiting this policy while the framework is as poor as it is.
But basically, there's a common line between Labor and the Conservatives on asylum seeker policy. Turnbacks is the big area of difference. And also, turnbacks, surely your policy at the moment would mean that you would be coming into government with a line that would send out a message to the people smugglers, well, try it out again.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I think I know what you're saying, Michelle. I don't see the issue in, you know, so firstly, I think there's a huge difference between what our views are and what their views are in our policy and their policy. You know, but putting that aside, I think you can't look at turnbacks in isolation. You have to look at it in terms of the overall policy. And I would be much more comfortable revisiting an issue like turnbacks if we'd initially visited big issues like Manus Island and Nauru.
Now, finally, there was a call recently by Kevin Rudd to further democratise the Labor Party. Structural reform's been a running issue for years now. What sort of steps do you think this conference will take or should take on giving the rank and file more
say? Yeah, okay. Well, I think, well, where do you start? There's so much to do in this space. I think, firstly, I think the rank and file do want more of a say in the policy development process, and I think some of that's already started. I think there's more to do in that space. Secondly, there are, you know, the last set of rules about the direct election of leader were kind of fostered on last minute. I think there is some checks and balances and cleaning up of those rules, and I think that's a good thing.
Oh, really? You want to make some changes there?
Well, no. I think some of the structural suggestions. I mean, firstly, it has to be put in the rules. Right. Yes. I mean, it's not in the rules at the moment, right?
This is the 50-50 election
so
system.
So it was done by caucus. It's not in the national platform yet. Of course, it's going to be. And that, I think there were questions about how you trigger a ballot, about how people vote.
Is it too hard now to trigger a ballot?
I don't think so, but...
Especially in opposition?
Yeah, I think it's very grey. I think part of the problem with...
What is the present rule?
The present rule, as I understand it, is this, is that you need, I believe it's 60% of caucus, and maybe 60% of the caucus to trigger it. What I'm not sure about, and I'd want to check this, is I'm not sure if it's automatically triggered after an election defeat. I think it probably should be if it's not. I suspect it is. In my reading of what went through the caucus rules, to be honest, and what I think we could probably look at, is that because of the nature and when it went through, and it went through kind of in the midst of an election, just in the election period, it's actually quite bare in terms of details. And so what wasn't a problem in the first ballot, I think having a lot of details nutted out, you know, just I think that's something that's going to need to happen. And there'll be obviously a lot of discussion, negotiation around that. Look, the bigger issue is where to from here for the party. I've got to say, Michelle, I have been a huge advocate of moving to primaries. I'm a bit concerned in two places that we held big primaries, which were Balmain and Newtown. Labor did still lose that to the Greens. And so one thing the New South Wales branch is doing, or will do, is actually have a look at all this and say, okay, is this the right thing to do? Is it not the right thing? Does it work? Does it not work? I have to say, from my personal perspective, someone who's been such a big advocate of it, and we had such fantastic primaries with such fantastic candidates. I mean, we had these great inner city candidates in Penny Sharp and Verity Firth, and you know, no one had been pushing stronger for primaries than I had. You suddenly turn around and go, okay, well, we still didn't win those seats. Now, you know, just because you didn't win a seat doesn't mean you did everything wrong, but was this a factor that helped? And if it wasn't, okay, well, maybe it was a waste of time. I don't know. This is the stuff we have to look at as part of the review.
Well, just on the Greens, it does seem that they're becoming an increasing problem to you in the lower house. Potentially one or two seats could be vulnerable next election.
Yeah, I mean, look, at a state level in New South Wales, I haven't seen the last count in Lismore, but the Greens won three, verging on four lower house seats. That is huge. And that is two of the seats they were taking off the National Party, two of the seats they took off us. But let's not kid ourselves, the two seats they took off the National Party, we would have liked them to be Labor seats.
So. And Anthony Albanese's seat in the inner city is going to be vulnerable next time, especially if he considers retiring.
Look, I think it's fair to say that while Anthony and Tanya, the federal seat of Sydney, wherever they want to be the members of parliament, I would be very... The incredible amount of community support they have, I imagine, is sustainable, and will continue to support them. Is the question that, is this a new battleground? Yeah, Of course it is. And we saw what happened in Melbourne. In the federal seat of Melbourne, when Lindsay Tanner resigned, it got lost to the Greens.
Yes, and then was held by the Greens at the next election.
Yeah, and I think it was held. And the other thing to concern yourself, I mean, for us to consider is the primary vote for the Greens in Newtown, again, this was on election night. It may have varied in the recount and, you know, postal votes and stuff. It was quite close to 50%. 50% primary votes are a really high vote.
So how does Labor meet this threat?
Well, I think that's a topic for a whole nother half an hour podcast.
All right. Thank you very much, Sam
Dastyari, so much
for joining us today. That was Senator Sam Dastyari. You can follow me on Twitter at Michelle Grattan. If you're using iTunes, please rate us and leave a comment. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll be back with another interview next week.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.